Hello, this is UCI Chancellor Dr. Howard Gilman. When I'm not busy dealing with the regents of the University of California, I like to unwind with KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine or online at kuci.org.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this June 19th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and always available via podcast. I'm your co-host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. This morning, I am excited to be joined by Karen Russell, and in the second half hour, I will be talking with Jessica Frances Kane. Karen Russell won the 2012 and 2018 National Magazine Award for Fiction. Her first novel, Swamplandia, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winner of the New York Public Library Young Lions Award, and one of the New York Times' 10 Best Books of 2011. She's the author of Vampires in the Lemon Grove and St. Lucie's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves. Karen has received a MacArthur Fellowship and a Guggenheim Award and is a former fellow of the NYPL Coleman Center and the Academy, American Academy in Berlin. She graduated summa cum laude from Northwestern University and received an MFA from Columbia's School of the Arts. Born and raised in Miami, she now lives in Portland, Oregon. She is the endowed chair of Texas State University's MFA program, where she teaches in the fall. Hopefully, she's going to teach us a little MFAing this morning. Her latest is Orange World and Other Stories, and it will drive our discussion this morning. Karen, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Marie.
Well, thanks for coming on. So I like to talk a little bit about, you know, when writers have kind of a body of work out there now. I like to, you know, just sort of take a quick look back and for you to kind of look back on your own work now that you have the three collections and the novel.
Right.
And just kind of talk about some of the things that have concerned you all the way along, you know, themes you see yourself continuing to come back to, and maybe some of the things that have been kind of new on your horizon with this collection.
Yeah, it's funny. I really do have to say, I feel sometimes like the least reliable narrator when it comes to my own work. I mean, I think that I learn so much from readers' responses, you know. Always surprising to me, kind of the echoes that come back book to book and then kind of over the arc of my history.
Yeah.
But there's some things that I think have changed pretty profoundly for me since St. Lucie's, which was my first collection, and there's some things that I just find continue to haunt, you know, haunt me and show up in the stories. So I wrote, you know, most of the characters in that first collection are children or adolescents who are kind of on the threshold of various kinds of metamorphoses. Metamorphoses still really fascinate me, you know, but in this book, there's sort of a woman who becomes a mother. There's, you know, individuals that become entangled in kind of a thorny relationship. You know, there's sort of a father who becomes a monster. So I think those kinds of transformations are still totally fascinating to me, but it's not always child to adult, you know, and which I think was the one that was sort of my first obsession.
Right.
Ghosts and monsters, you know, I think like as a vocabulary sort of to talk about some of the strangeness of transforming in time as a person, you know, I think like, I mean, monsters are still chock-a-block in this new book. And landscape in a big way. I mean, I think it, even when I think I'm doing something sort of really new, right? So I left Florida for a long time in Vampires, my second book, and in this book too, there's not a ton of stories that are set sort of in my backyard as there were in my earlier work. But I think that's still, it's still like the Ur fascination for me, sort of just, you know, where does a human personality intersect with non-human nature, and how do these geographies kind of shape the plots of our lives, you know? either because you are born into some kind of resource bottleneck and you just can't get what you need in this particular ecosystem, you know, whether it's like the ecosystem of a family or, you know, your wider community or, you know, the literal land, right? You can't get anything to grow there, quite literally. Or it's sort of where we're leaving, you know, in this new collection. I think there are quite a few stories where people launch, you know, from a home into some unknown.
Yes, right. Yeah, so let's talk about that and the kind of the introduction and the landscape of this collection, because it feels like this collection, more than maybe some of the others, you know, the world has been pressing in on us, on all of us in uncomfortable ways. You know, so it felt like climate change was on your mind a little bit. It felt like the war on women, the war on immigrants, all that stuff, you know, was really subtextual in this context. And so talk about, you know, these eight stories and kind of how they came together. I assume not every story that one writes can make it into a cohesive collection, but these, you know, felt like they were really in conversation with each other.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, I felt that way too, and I left quite a few stories out, doing that kind of curatorial work, I sort of love, you know, in part because it just means that, thank God, right, you have a book,
right,
at last, you know, which is just never feels like a given, you know, for years plural.
right.
And just speaking of, you know, strange speculative gamble, you know. I also think that I might sort of see some secret ligature between the stories that I'm not sure would be obvious to readers or even necessary for them to have. But definitely, I'm noticing that in art so much, in all kinds of medium, right, film and music. And you see the way that our time is pressurized to such an extent that it's all showing up quickly in art, you know? Did you have that experience? I just felt like right after the election particularly, there was sort of no lag between everybody's collective, like, ontological crisis and sort of there's a real reckoning that was taking place in stories that were being published, you know? And that was sort of a little bit new for me, you know? Swamplandia is a book so much about kind of family and I was an adult myself when I started that, and I hadn't lived in Florida, you know, for 5 years. So usually I think if I'm writing about something, there's a little bit of a lag, you know, or there's kind of, it's been assimilated into my memory or my body in a different way before it shows up in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So it is just interesting. I do sort of feel part of like this swarming mm-hmm. that's happening where maybe because the, you know, we have these overlapping crises that feel so urgent and, you know, these very real threats, it seems like, you know, to our democracy, to our climate, you know, and so I guess it's not surprising that people who have their, like, dream antenna out are kind of picking up on the same signals. It's just interesting to me, you know, the different ways they manifest. So, you know, I don't think that the bad graft would seem to anybody overtly like a story about climate change, but it is sort of, it's like a love and horror story about this couple that I was thinking of as like a weird desert version of Apollo and Daphne, where instead of becoming a tree, you know, this Joshua tree jumps into this woman.
Mm-hmm.
just sounds insane in paraphrase, but one of the things that was like, that I got really interested in like a nerdy way was, you know, incredible codependency of these two species, the Joshua tree, this like ancient plant, and the yucca moss, and how they've kind of co-evolved so that if, you know, they're kind of both the resilience, right, because these are, you know, this is a long-standing romance between these two species, and also their total fragility, and, you know, especially at a time when it just seems like, you know, there are these mass extinctions that seem imminent. So I guess as a meditation on just both kind of like human interdependency, how a love story can become a horror story and vice versa when two people are completely dependent on one another, when they've made their story together, and then kind of broadening the lens a little bit and thinking about, you know, interdependency more generally on this planet. So that's the kind of thing where I don't even know that a reader that that would ever be their takeaway, but it was sort of in the back of my mind. And I'm sure it was there because we're all funneling a new awareness of how quickly and profoundly we're affecting our literal atmosphere, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, if it is the case that people write to understand, and a lot of writers tell me that's the reason they write is to understand the world they're living in, then, you know, you're trying to process all of this stuff, as you say, in real time. And I think that's kind of the brain's subconscious way of doing
that. Oh, totally. And I feel that way as a reader, too. You know, I think the kind of time that exists inside a book feels more necessary to me now than ever. You know, I was just, you know, I get off a plane. You know, I just arrived in Austin to do an event. I find that I, like, brace myself unconsciously before I turn my phone back on. Because there's just this domino rally of misfortune, you know. And it's like, I feel like my processing speed hasn't caught up to how quickly all of these other lives are impinging on us.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, and it's also like nothing's out of bounds. Like, if you turn on your phone and read that half the country caught fire and, like, fell into the sea, you know, it just seems like there's nothing.
Yeah, that would. Yeah, every time I pick up the Onion, I'm like, "Is it the Onion?
Yes, yes, exactly." So that's a really surreal way to exist, you know. And so I think, thank God, really, for books, because it's a completely different kind of time signature.
Right. Right.
And you can discover how other consciousnesses are processing this very strange place. There's something really consoling about that to me, you know.
It does strike me as a really funny time to be writing magical realism at a time when the world feels a bit magically real, you know.
I do sort of think, though, that I'm not even sure. It doesn't feel to me sometimes like I'm really pushing the envelope that far.
Yeah.
It feels to me like maybe a kind of distortion or exaggeration, but that ultimately still what I'm trying to write about feels very real, you know, to me.
Yeah. And,
you know, so if like a devil shows up or somebody, you know, becomes like a bloodless, ruminative version of themselves. It's just, you know, I'm like, this all feels like it's well within the domain of the possible.
Yes.
To me.
Right, right.
It might just be like a slight alteration or just some, you know, just like a slight dilation of reality, but maybe that's it, right? It's like things, we're living in such an extreme time that it would almost, I wouldn't even know how to write about it if it was going to be like a strictly realist tale kind of confined to
the rules.
I mean, just, I think because what Wednesday looks like and what Wednesday feels like to me right now, you know, like if you were to just sort of log what you did moment to moment versus what that feels like, there's a real gulf there, you know?
Right, right. But all of that can't be in you. So when you sit down to the page, even though you have all of this swirling stuff in your subconscious about everything that's going on, tell me a little bit about how you guide yourself into the story. Because it sounds like from other things I have read about you, you are very word by word, sentence by sentence. The second sentence doesn't happen until the first sentence is perfect.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if those words lead you to the story as opposed to you already having some concept of the story in mind and then sitting down to find the right words for it. Does that make
sense?
Right.
I think it really depends. You know, I think sometimes, I think if a story works at all, definitely the sentences will lead me to something better than my initial idea or ambition for it. I mean, without fail, that seems to be the case, you know, because I think what you were saying about writers wanting to understand this place, if I have too fixed of an idea or too definite of a destination, those stories are the ones that tend to kind of fail, I think, because it just feels unrealistic to me. Like, if you're not surprising yourself or discovering something, how could you transfer that pleasure to a reader?
Uh-huh,
you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It would just feel kind of like paint by numbers. So when I have kind of maybe two, when I go in with like two sort of I feel like I'm too committed almost to sort of how a metaphor is going to play out or whatever, then those are kind of like dead in the water, you know?
Sure.
But I do sort of think, you know, with the Bog Girl, there's a story in this collection where I really did have an idea of what the hinge would be and wrote towards that, not totally understanding. There were sort of other surprises along the way.
Mm.
This relationship this young man has with his mother, I just didn't anticipate that she would be a character at all.
Mm.
So they're funny things. You know what I mean? They're sort of, I'm always surprised, but in that case, I really, structurally, I was thinking, okay, well, there's going to be a turn in the last third of this story. And that helped me a little bit to kind of riff and play around the edges figure out who these people were, you know?
Yeah, right. Is that often the case for the story that you know something out in the distance, not necessarily the ending, but something in the farther distance of the story?
Right. I mean, so The Prospectors is another story where I sort of knew up until the point that these two women discover for themselves that they've really arrived at the wrong party.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I had no idea, you know. So, yeah, sometimes. I mean, with The Bad Graft, I think I really just had this idea that this woman was going to be infected by a Joshua tree.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all I really knew. And then had to sort of, like, wander around that landscape for a while to figure out. So, okay, given that this is what's happening, you know, because you don't know anything about these people necessarily, right? I think that's the wild thing. I've had that experience as a student and as a teacher of students where, you know, we're all treating these people as, like, fully dimensioned people, which is, on the one hand, a big compliment. If you're a writer, you're like, oh, I'm so happy that you think of them as characters with complex personalities, but I just met them 2 weeks ago. You know, you can feel sometimes, feel like that's cool. 48 hours ago, I didn't know these strangers, so I can't speak to your question about their motivations.
Right. You had said in some interview that I think this is really helpful for writers, that Jim Shepherd, who's a, you know, wonderful short story writer, had done this Venn diagram with his students where he put, you know, here's me and, you know, here's anxious, crazy writer me. And then here's, you know, Bog Girl, or not Bog Girl, because she's not, anyway, here's the guy in the story. And you have to kind of Venn diagram them to figure out, you know, the shade where they intersect is how you bring those characters to life. And I thought that's kind of a helpful way for writers to think about breathing, you know, life into these characters of how do I intersect with this person in order to make them feel fully realized and like they have a life off the page.
Isn't that just a great visual?
It is. Yeah. It is.
I think Jim Shepherd, he's a friend. I'm sure he's going to be like, please stop ventriloquizing me badly all across the land. Like, I'm sure he's so eloquent, you know. But I really love that idea because I do think that's part of the mysterious work of making a story live. And it's just really individual, but figuring out what is your own access point as a writer and how can you use your life to power this life on paper.
Right.
You know, and that is a really a spooky challenge.
Yeah, right.
And I think writers find really different power outlets to plug into, you know. I feel like it's so private, sort of what makes everybody want to do this in the first place. But it is true that I think, like, you know, I was rambling before about wanting to find a way to sync up the story with your own obsession or your own unanswered question, right? Or you're saying something that you want to discover. And that's really necessary for there to be heat on the page, right?
Well, I was thinking of that with Orange World. Maybe this is because my only child is launching into the world this fall.
Congratulations.
I think, it's a it's a strange time of life. So I found myself reading the story and just sobbing in my in my kitchen. And I was thinking, you know, that age-old question of do we have to write what we know?
Right.
And I thought, I wonder if a man could have written this story. And the job of a writer, I think, is to be empathetic and to be able to, breathe life into people that we aren't. But then I was like, God, this feels so uniquely difficult to write if you hadn't gone through motherhood.
I think one of the most amazing things about publishing that story, I mean, really one of, like, the real kind of gifts of, you know, my whole time publishing anything was hearing from so many, I mean, really close friends in some cases too, you know, that it resonated with them on some mammalian level.
Yes, right.
On some really ancient mammalian level.
It did.
I felt like, you know, that was something even, I mean, during my last pregnancy and in the weeks and months immediately after, it was interesting because it was sort of right during Me Too, right? So on the one hand, there was this like mass exorcism or thaw happening where all of these stories were coming to light, you know, these unspeakable truths were suddenly being aired publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And there seemed something so healing. I mean, there's, on the one hand, what a horror story, because the ubiquity of some of these experiences was so sad to me, so terrifying, right? That it's just one person's, you know, most intimate nightmare was actually part of like a really old story and absolutely commonplace, you know.
Right.
And somehow it felt analogous a little bit. I mean, but what felt analogous about it was just feeling, on the one hand, this is a very old story. Like, it's not a new story to become a mother. It turns out, like, this is maybe the oldest story, in fact, of our species. And also, it just felt so totally shocking to me and really undid me and muted me for a little while in some ways. And I really felt scalded by this fear. And then so many people that these other women were like, oh, yeah, you know.
Yeah. It's new to you,
though. I
wanted to
try to capture some sense of that in this story, right, where instead of having, like, your one private demon, you sort of realize, like, oh, well, the news is mixed, you know.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know, are you sitting down? The news is mixed. You're not alone with this, but also, yes, you're up against.
And it ain't getting better. Yeah.
It's not getting better, right? It's not getting, yeah. And after that, do you know that Marie Howe line from part of Eve's discussion? I think it's my favorite last line in any poem. It's just, and after that, it was still like that, only all the time.
Oh.
Isn't that great?
That's great. That's it's fantastically devastating. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what these stories are. They're the oldest stories in time, and yet they're new to, you know, whoever's going through it the first time.
It's, I mean, falling in love, very similar, right?
Right.
Where
right.
I sort of felt, I've always felt that, though. I think, like, if I felt like a little bit less bewildered, maybe I wouldn't have to write these stories.
Yeah,
you
right.
know, but there is this way where, yeah, you see the people ahead of you on the escalator, and you're like, it sort of seems impolite and like a little gauche to just be screaming and screaming about this, but this is very bizarre.
What else do we do?
What else? You know what? And books have always been such a consolation that way, because I'm like, oh, thank goodness, there's a sort of, it is so different than what's possible in like a conversation in time, even with people that you love the most, right, and feel the closest to.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, I mean, you get access to people's primal stuff that not even they are often aware that they had. I mean, the like I say, the emotion that took me by surprise reading Orange World, I didn't know was there until it was there. And it's a lovely surprise for both maybe the reader and the writer.
Oh, that makes me so happy, because that's my favorite experience too, where something is magnetized in you as well, right? The ghost ship surfaces. You didn't maybe have access to that yourself, right? Before the right words in the right order, like, dredged it out of you. And that, I love that feeling so much.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing I wanted to talk about was kind of playing all the notes on the story scale, which is what you do. I mean, you juxtapose humor with horror, with anguish, with joy. And I don't know if that's something that can be taught or that you can give advice on. But I was wondering if, when you look at a story once it's done, do you kind of look at the story for emotional balance? Like, do you say, oh, this is too dark, so I need a little bit of humor here, or I need to add a little light there, or some levity dialogue? Or is it just so organic that that's just your voice and we can't hope to aspire to it?
Oh, that's so kind. I feel like... feels so much more like just riding a unicycle badly and like listing in all directions, you know, just trying not to fall on your ass. Like, I don't know if that's the right image to give your listeners, but mean,
it's
I really
true.
Feel like sometimes, you know, it's funny to do interviews, right? Because I start to kind of fall for my own post-talk confabulations about how these stories came into being, and I forget that actually for most of the time, it just felt like if you could get the unicycle across the stage, that would have to be a success. Like, you know, you just sort of abandon all of your loftier aspirations, and you're just like, I'm going to call it a win if I don't fall on my ass in front of these people and just make it to the other side of the stage.
That's fair.
Unfortunately, that's so much more of my experience of writing.
That is so funny.
But I do. Yeah, I have a friend, and this seemed like a much better way to work. Actually, he's super funny and super sad and super dark. And he said he does different passes for different emotions, which I thought was so interesting. So he'll do, you know, he'll do a revision just for humor, and then he'll sort of do a revision where he's just looking at, you know, how the sadness is manifesting, whatever. And
that's good.
But I think it is sort of like this weird intuitive thing, and I think I get it. I really think I do get it wrong a lot in first drafts, where that's still like a learning curve for me, is figuring out when the humor is really in the service of the horror, you know, when they're working together instead of, you know, a joke that kind of ventilates a pressure that needs to be there. And having both present, I mean, the Bog Girl was a funny challenge for me because to me, it was both like genuinely horrifying and also really funny, and it had something to do with like the distance from the canvas, you know. So there's this sort of detached omniscience in that story that that felt better to me than first person, because it meant that you could sort of zoom out a little bit and have this like more wry, you know, crow horse voice that was almost, or like the voice of the bog itself, right? That isn't really attending to kind of like the tragedy and comedy of human living in quite the same way as we would, with like our eye level identification. And then it would just sometimes be like in the house, you know, with this boy and his mom and his girlfriend, and, you know, his 2,000-year-old girlfriend. And there it felt, you know, more sort of, yeah, that just felt funnier to me and sadder to me on like a human plane.
Right.
But somebody who I think does this really well is Annie Prue, and she's been a good teacher to me, because she can write these stories where it's sort of the people are almost like geologic features of the landscape, you know, and there is that kind of like awesome, sublime detachment. Joy Williams, too, I think is the master of this.
Yeah.
And then there will be these really intimate moments, these really, you know. But it's hard.
It's hard.
I think it's a funny thing to... I just think that that's a lot of the work of revision, is sort of that kind of, exactly that kind of tonal fine-tuning. I think some readers really don't like a tonally complex story. I think it unnerves them, you know. They want to know, like, is this supposed to be funny, or am I supposed to be feeling sorry for these people? You know, they want more more instruction.
Right. I know you got to dash off. The other thing that I thought was really helpful that you had said at some point was taking, I think it was a piece of Flaubert for Madame Bovary's Greyhound, and getting into his syntax and actually mechanically copying out passages from him to help you just mechanically get into that story.
Yes. I think if nothing else, that is actually like a great, I feel good about that advice.
Yeah.
And it helps too with other, you know, if you're feeling stuck for other reasons. I was telling somebody, it's like, it's just like inviting a haunting, right? You're inviting other voices to kind of influence you and get in your bloodstream. Because I can really get into a rut, like, you know, just even syntactically. You know what I mean? Right. Do you ever write a sentence? You're like, this is such a Marie sentence. Like,
right. Yeah.
This is like such, this is so my way of like, you know, compacting, you know, describing reality.
Right.
And it's nicer, I mean, some of these other writers have much longer natural lines than I do. And there's something really virtuosic to me about people who can scaffold a really long sentence and what that lets you do, like the kind of nuances you can get into clause to clause. So, and the opposite is true. I mean, sometimes there are these, like, you know, subject, verb, object, like the, you know, Tim O'Brien. I mean, I think everyone who reads The Things They Carry then writes that, you know, writes to that rhythm for like the next 5 months.
Right.
So, but it's not, but that's, you know, what an excellent thing, right? To sort of follow other people's. I find that's an amazing thing to me about reading, in a way that, like, you could watch Simone Biles and never execute a right. one of her jumps, but
right,
you
right.
can copy out these sentences.
It is funny, just the you're right, the physical act of writing it down and even doing it by longhand yeah. and not on your computer
yes.
is really interesting. Or sometimes I'll be reading a book and before I turn the page, I'll try to anticipate what the next word is. And 50% of the time I'm wrong, even if it's so yeah. obvious what it has to be. And
isn't that amazing?
It kind of shows
but I
you
really
the breadth
think, of and I, it's so funny. I'm thinking of Annie Prue again, but she'll do that to me where it's like whatever adverb she's picked to kind of like, you know, whatever push pin she's chosen for that part of the map. It's a total surprise to me.
So cool.
And yeah. I wouldn't have guessed that word, you know, you see that it's also surprising and feels true, but it's nothing that you in a million years of thinking would have chosen yourself, you know.
And it shows you the scope of language and what language can do and how vast it is. And you, mm-hmm. you know, you think you're getting some mastery over it and it just laughs in your face. It's just not true. is there any last minute advice, wisdom, anything we should have talked about that we forgot to talk about?
Oh dear. You know, no. I've just, in my dotage, just now that I have, for some reason, this unlikely ability to, like, spout off advice randomly. But I do sort of think, I feel this with some of my fiction students, you know, what a good teacher poetry is for fiction writing.
Mm, yeah.
And I, like, went kicking and screaming into a poetry class. I was like, I don't understand it. I don't, you know, I came to poetry late, relatively late in life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the best teacher, just speaking exactly to that point of sort of like you, these metaphoric captures that you would never conceive of on your own and that, you know, just drive right into the heart of some feeling or truth.
Mm-hmm.
And also just having to really slow down and pay attention word to word and line to line, you know, getting control on the level of the line. I think it just made more sense to me sometimes to, and the poet, that's still who I'll read also if I'm feeling really creatively dead, you know.
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and it even the line breaks and everything. I know
yes.
novels can't do quite that, but even in The Prospectors, there was a little line about death that you played around with the line breaks, and it was so effective, I thought. And
I'm glad. There's something about that, right? I mean, I do think stories are like poems in that way, that you're making these leaps of feeling and leaps of logic even, right? Sort of they have their own kind of dream logic.
Right, right. Yeah, so cool in that way. So cool in many ways. I'm glad to see this short story sort of enjoying a resurgence. It felt like it was a little dormant for a couple of decades there, and now it feels like it's coming.
I feel like there's so many just badass women writers of short fiction right now. I was just reading Leslie Arima. Did you know that book?
Oh, yes.
The Man Who Fell from the Sky. Oh, my God. It's so great.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was so happy to see Carmen Maria Machado have her apotheosis.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're just, people are doing some weird, amazing things right now.
So many good things. Yeah. I mean, if there's anything that comes of this dark time we're living through, I think some really amazing, interesting art is going to come out of it.
Yes.
You know, if you can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes. No, I agree. And that there's something subversive and amazing about that too, right? That feels like a radically free space
yeah.
still, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Let's hope for that. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, Karen Russell, thank you so much for taking time this morning. This was really wonderful.
Well, I had a blast. Thanks so much, Marie.
Me too. We are going to take a very short break. We will be right back with Jessica Frances Cain. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Welcome back to Writers on Writing. You are tuned in. I am your host, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. We are carrying on. If you missed any part of this show and would like to hear a podcast of it, you can visit iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook. We're under also Writers on Writing. You can find us on our websites, barbaraspenonfire.com, minemariestone.com, and you can catch us up there. Onward with the show, Jessica Frances Cain.
Jessica Frances Cain is the author of This Close, The Report, and Bending Heaven. This Close was longlisted for the Story Prize and the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, and The Report was a Barnes & Noble Discover New Writers selection and a finalist for the Flannery Dunnan First Novel Prize, The Center of Fiction. Her stories and essays have appeared in a number of publications, including Virginia Quarter Review, McSweeney's, The Missouri Review, The Yale Review, A Public Space, and Granta. Rules for Visiting is her latest. It's published by Penguin Press, and it's the subject in part of our chat this morning. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Glad to be here.
So before we dive into the book itself, you've had a couple of novels, a short story collection, So I'd love to kind of explore kind of the arc of your work and kind of look back on it as a whole and kind of enduring themes and areas of interest and maybe how your work or your focus has changed over time. Do you ever do that, kind of look back over the whole thing and say, where have I been and where am I going?
Right. What exactly am I doing?
No.
Yes, sure. Probably no one is more amazed than I am that I'm publishing a second novel. I really started as a short story writer. I guess as many do. But I was convinced that I might be a writer who only published short stories, if I would be allowed to do that. It took me a long time to figure out how to write long, how to figure out the arc of a novel. And my first novel, The Report, actually started, I thought it would just be a story, and then I thought, well, maybe it's a novella, and I sort of crept up on the idea that I was writing a novel. And it took 10 years to write that first novel, so. And in the meantime, I had written many of the stories that were in This Close. So I really thought after The Report came out and then I did another story collection, I thought I'll probably do another story collection. But then Rules for Visiting came along and actually grew out of one of the stories that was in This Close, which I didn't feel quite done with. And so that had always been my dream. I'd heard that happening to other writers, that a story grew into a novel, but it hadn't happened for me yet, and then it did. So the story Essentials for Acceleration in my collection This Close has some of the seeds of what became Rules for Visiting. And even though some of the original idea of Rules for Visiting goes way back, goes actually 15 years back, the writing of the book itself was very fast once I realized that I could expand this story. And I wrote Rules for Visiting faster than I've written anything. I had a full draft in about 18 months, which is,
don't you love those gifts?
For me. Yes, very much. I don't know if it'll happen again, but I enjoyed it while I had it.
Right, right.
And that was a very interesting experience. And but I do believe in the idea that work percolates for a long time. As I said, some of the ideas in Rules for Visiting go back to events that happened in 2003, and that I had notes about and that I'd been reading about, and then the novel wasn't written until 2017, really.
Okay.
So it takes time for work to mature, and the older I get and the more I've written, the more I believe in that process. And when I was younger, I was very eager to just have more pages, more writing, and now I'm a little more patient, I think.
Well, and it's a good sign, I think, that a work stays with you for that long. You know, if you're thinking about something for 10 or 12 years or 15 years, that's probably a sign that it is interesting enough, not only just for you to sustain your attention in writing it, but also for the reader, that something in there is really enduring and really matters. Yeah,
right.
So you may have already answered this question, but the book begins in the prologue by essentially kind of posing a question, which is, you know, kind of a best friend is someone who, and then, you know, we're meant to fill in the blank. And so, you know, and it kind of unspools around that question of friendship, specifically women's friendships and kind of how those relationships are evolving in the digital age. And I was kind of curious if that was how the book originally, I know it started with this story, but does work often start with kind of a question like that for you, if there's some question at the center of it that you're trying to answer?
That's interesting. I think there is a question, maybe more than character. Well, I don't know. I feel as if I have to have a question and a character almost together. Mm-hmm. With the report, that's a novel based on an accident that happened in World War II in London, and the question was how does somebody write a public a government report about an accident, and how is that done, and how is that done quickly to answer all the questions the community has about this tragedy that's happened to them. Mm-hmm. And so that was the question I was trying to answer, but I had the character of the magistrate in mind as well. And then with Rules for Visiting, I had that question of what is a best friend, what makes a best friend, and what is it possible to get better at friendship? That was kind of mainly it. I wanted to write a book in which a woman sort of recognizes that she's not particularly good at friendship and wonders if she can get better if she sets her mind to it and sort of goes on a journey to visit friends she's fallen out of touch with. So I wanted to answer that question. Can you set your mind to it and get better at friendship the way you might get better at cooking, you know, or something if you took time to do that? But that I had that question in mind for several years before I had the voice of Mae Attaway. And so I was just, I guess it was just steeping in my mind. And I was taking notes. I keep notebooks, and I was taking notes toward it, but it wasn't, I wouldn't have called it a book yet. I really didn't know what I was doing with it. It was just some material I was interested in. And then one day I had Mae Attaway's voice, and once I had her voice and could hear her, then the book came very fast, as I said earlier. So it's some combination of a question I'm trying to answer and that I'm thinking hard about, and a character.
Yeah. So talk about hearing her voice, kind of how that happened and how maybe you mined her out.
Yes. Well, it's so two things happened in quick succession, which is that scene that opens the book where she is actually, I set it in an airport, and she sees someone carrying a book bag, and on the book bag are the words, a best friend is someone who, and then she can't finish the sentence because presumably the sentence finishes on the other side of the book bag, and she doesn't see that. That actually happened to me in real life, but not in an airport. It happened, I was running on the Hudson River in New York City where I live, and that experience happened. I saw somebody with a book bag that said that, and I did a double take, and I circled back around, but I couldn't find her in the crowd, and so I was left to ponder that phrase and how I might answer it. And a few days later, I was looking through my notebook in which I'd been keeping notes about friendship, and I'd been reading friendship novels for several years, seeking them out whenever I could. And then all of a sudden I wrote what became the first sentence of part one, actually, where she admits that she's sort of stalled in life. Midway through my 40th year, I reached a point where the balance of the past and all it contained seemed to outweigh the future. Mm-hmm. And that sentence just, it's a kind of long sentence. I didn't read the whole thing here, but it came complete and all at once. And then that was May. And I don't know. I just heard her after that.
I love that.
It's kind of a, you do feel haunted a bit, I think.
Right.
I'd never written most of my stories, too, were not in the first person. Most of my stories are in the third person. And so I was astonished to find myself writing a novel in the first person, because that just seemed to me like that would be very hard to sustain over. I love reading them. They're among my favorite books to read, but I thought that I wouldn't be up to it. And then suddenly I had May talking to me, and I did.
I totally agree with you. I love reading them, and they do seem, as you're writing them, they sometimes seem claustrophobic, or I don't even know what the, you know,
right.
it's hard to.
Yeah, no, they can. Yes, exactly.
Right. Actually, something that you just said about this experience of running in the park and seeing the book bag, and as I was reading the prologue to this, when she sees this woman in the airport, I was like, in today's day and age, I would just go home if I was curious and Google it. You know, I'd put the phrase in and I'd look for book bags and I'd find out what the answer is. And that really is one of the themes of the book, right? I mean, that
it totally is. Yes, it's funny. I did not think of that, and I think May wouldn't have thought of that either,
right?
Since she's kind of a little out of step with modern technology. But that's right. Yeah.
Exactly. That theme of technology and how it's affecting our friendships is certainly also an enduring one throughout the book,
yeah.
Which I just love because it's true and because we don't ask ourselves philosophical questions anymore because we try to Google the answers and don't go on these wonderful mental journeys.
That's right. We do. And that's something I was thinking about when I was writing it was just how this digital age is affecting friendship. I mean, I know we're all sort of thinking about that to a certain extent, but while I was writing, I started clipping, literally clipping the actual, I would print them out and put them in a folder. I do most of my news reading online, but I have to have paper if I'm working from something to make a book. Mm-hmm. So I was collecting articles about friendship and the way social media seems to be changing it and changing our conception of the word friend. And all of that, you know, was emerging while in the years I was thinking about this book. And by the time I was writing the book, it seemed to me that I was seeing people, you know, really beginning to question it, really either taking the step of stepping back from social media or limiting their time on social media, questioning what our friendships do mean. You know, if we're only liking things instead of telling our best friends our news, but we put it all online first, you know, that how that feels. Mm-hmm. I just think people are really starting to think about this, and that's what I wanted to have in the book, because I do think friendship is evolving. I don't know what exactly will be the end point, but I think we are losing something when we don't spend face-to-face time with our friends and we just substitute with social media, right, which is what May kind of experiments with. So she decides that she's going to show up and see her friends.
Right. So I, it's funny, we're a third of the way into the interview, and I think that I probably didn't adequately ask you to totally introduce the book. We've introduced May and we've introduced the themes, but we haven't introduced the book. So if we haven't done a totally adequate job of that, I'll let you do that and kind of take everybody into the full scope of what the novel is.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I guess what we did not do is say that she goes on this kind of odyssey over time to introduce or to reacquaint herself with these four important women,
yes,
of her past.
Exactly.
Yeah. I guess that was the part
That's
we left
right.
out.
She gets she's granted some extra time off of work, and she decides to use it to go visit these four friends with whom she's fallen out of touch over the years with, but she at one time they were important to her, but she's become a bit distant from them, and she decides that she will go and spend time with them, in part because she wants to see how they really live. She wants to see if she wants to spend real time. She wants to see how they live. She wants to see their ordinary lives. She doesn't want to be entertained. She doesn't want to do special things. She just wants to be with them in their lives in order to really, in a way, she's looking for clues as to how to live her own life. Mm-hmm. And so she sets out on these four trips over the course of a year, the book has, I won't give away the ending.
Right.
I was trying to earn a somewhat happy ending with it, not have it be too sad.
Right. It's such a beautiful premise. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's a very inspiring premise. And it also, we should say, so May is a landscape architect, and the book is kind of organized around nature in opposition to,
yes,
technology and landscape and, you know, all the dirt and the flowers and the trees, all these really tangible, natural stuff. And I was thinking,
right,
as you mentioned, that you were essentially, you thought, a short story writer as opposed to essentially a novelist. Obviously, you do both well, but that maybe giving yourself these organizing principles and these ways to structure the novel almost as, I mean, it really reads as a novel and not as linked short stories, but to kind of trick your own writer mind to writing a longer piece through either these four. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I think that's, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I agree. I agree.
Yeah.
I think that's very true. I think that's the thing that I realized about my own writing in writing Rules for Visiting, that that structure, I have to have a sense of the structure. And once that's in place, then I'm able to write it, because I think it's it comes from that sense of an arc. And if I know, I have to sort of know, where the scaffolding is, and I can build then from piece to piece. So I have to have the sense of the structure first. So for example, I knew I had I had four journeys out to see each friend, but I knew that she was going to have to come home. Also, I didn't just want it to be a sequence of visits. So I knew that there would have to be a home life too, and she'd come back each time. But I didn't want it to just be out and back, you know, so I realized I kind of wanted a third thing. And actually, I was very inspired. This probably seems odd to everybody else, but somehow it made sense in my head. I loved the book H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald. And one of the things I loved about that book was the way she layered the sort of three stories. There was the story of the grief of her father dying, and then the memoir of her raising her goshawk, and then the story of T.E. White and his goshawk. Mm-hmm. And I just loved how those three things were layered and worked together. And I decided, even though I was writing a novel, there's a way in which I wanted this novel to sort of sound like a memoir, a year's effort towards something, visiting friends. And so I layered in the trees. I wanted there to be a lot of information about trees, and sort of to tell some of the story through the trees that she and her father are obsessed with, because they're trading information about trees back and forth so that she can choose a memorial tree to plant for him once he dies. So that is actually where that inspiration came from.
So great.
From H is for Hawk.
And then also kind of running along the spine of the novel is the idea of Odysseus and Penelope and the journey story, which also I think kind of felt like an anchor both for the reader, and I don't know about you as the writer, but also another one of those touch points where you could, because I just get so lost in structure. I mean, novels are so huge, and there's so many different layers. And so, yeah, if you pre-build some of these layers in, like, you know, a journey story, and you're right, this metaphor of the trees and nature, at least for the writer part of it, it feels like it would give you something to kind of hang your hat on each chapter.
Exactly. Yeah, it really helps. And then sometimes I think, you know, you come to the end and you might realize that there are things that some of the scaffolding in a way you can take out. You know, I actually, the book does a lot of quoting quotes about friendship from philosophers and writers through the centuries. But there was a lot more of that. And every part, there are five parts to the novel, and each part opened with its own epigraph. And again, that was all scaffolding that I was building towards. Each of those quotes was very precious to me, and they were instrumental when I was writing. But when the thing was all done, my editor and I looked at it, and actually it was my editor, bless her, who said, you know, I don't think you need all of these quotes. I think it's scaffolding you can take away now. And I knew right away she was right. It just seemed spot on, but I hadn't seen it myself, and I had needed them there to build the book in the first place, but then they could come away.
That's interesting. Were there other aspects that you felt like, I call it overcoming the short story? I'm trying to do that myself right now, because I always love short stories and writing short stories, but if you're thinking about something bigger, were there other things that you had to kind of mentally overcome to write to shift from short story to novel, and kind of how you went about doing that?
I did. I'd say the other thing that immediately comes to mind is a sense of actually holding back a little bit, keeping secrets, not telling everything too quickly, because I think in a short story you just don't have a lot of space, and so you really just get in, get out, go on, right? And so when you have a novel, I think you really have to learn to breathe and relax and recognize that there's time, and you don't have to get it all in the first 10 pages, that's easier said than done, I think. Mm-hmm. So it took me a while to learn how to hold back, actually, and save things for later. That said, I would, you know, if on any given morning, if I was sort of stuck, A good trick I find is to go skip ahead and go to something I know I want to write that I think is part of the book, but I don't know where it's going to fit, but I know I'm excited about it. So I will just go to that and see, you know, can I write a page of that just because I want to get the words going? You know, so that's actually a trick I use, but it's not, it's different than remembering when I'm starting to save things for later in the novel.
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to ask you about that. If you wrote the book completely linearly as it happened, or if you do allow yourself to skip around, and that's good. I mean, that gives writers permission to say, okay, you know, if I'm just slogging through right now and nothing's coming and I'm stalled, there are options to get you out of that. I don't know if that's a technique you use for either writer's block or writer's boredom.
Either, really. right. Yes, I do not write linearly. I don't. I there are many who do. Many who outline and write very linearly, but I don't. And when I say that I need to know the structure, I should emphasize that doesn't mean I outline. It's more a sense of a shape or something that I know I want the book to have, but it's more ambiguous than an outline. And then I end up rearranging. In the two books I've written, the two novels I've written, my chapters tend to be on the shorter side, and I have done with both books so much cutting and pasting and rearranging to get the right order, to get the flow right. So. Even if I did write from beginning to end, I'm sure I would then just shuffle it and all at the end anyway. So it's almost a matter of a puzzle, fitting a puzzle together.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I hear a lot of writers say they know the beginning and they know the ending and they have no idea what the middle is. Did you, but it sounds like you did kind of know some of the touch points in the middle, but did you know the ending without giving the ending away? Did you know where you were trying to get to?
I think I had a sense. There are two storylines. I don't want to give away too much, but there's a storyline with the mother, May's mother and father, and she's her family is, and then there's a brother too. But she's kind of not estranged from her family, but they're sort of at she keeps them at arm's length.
Yeah.
And the story with the father, I think I didn't know how that was going to evolve. The story with the mother, I did, and then the brother, the way the brother and the father finished the novel was kind of a happy surprise to me. I as I said earlier, I actually was writing this novel after the election of 2016 and was feeling very down and feeling like I wanted to write a book that had some optimism in it and had some an earned happy ending, something that was had an outlook that suggested hope.
Mm-hmm,
I guess I was looking for that in any way I could, and so something in the book turned right around that time, and I added a number of things that were sort of, to my mind, a little bit of social commentary about the current state of affairs, and work toward a more hopeful ending with the father-daughter relationship.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I should mention my guest this morning is Jessica Frances Kane. The book is Rules for Visiting. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'd also love to ask you about interior characters. May is a very interior, self-reflective, fine to be on her own, maybe a little reclusive at the beginning. And I can get those characters stuck in a room and never out of it. You know, I could have written May's mother all day long to just go to bed and never get out of bed. So talk about maybe some of the difficulties in dealing with a character like that, getting them up and moving, getting them out into the world and dialoguing, and if that part of her was a challenge.
That's I know exactly what you mean, and it's true, it is a challenge. I was inspired by something I heard the writer Stuart Onan say once at a conference, and he's one of my favorite writers. I love his novels, and he talked about And of course, his, you know, if you think of Emily Alone, and I haven't read Henry himself yet, but I'm really excited to, they're very interior characters.
Yes.
And he was talking a little bit about this problem, and he was saying that what he does is he takes his character out into the world with him. And it's a simple idea, but I hadn't thought of it. And I started thinking about that with May. So when I'm out and about in the world, I would pretend literally that I was May, like, you know, and it's, this is a blurry line because of course, first person narrators and the authors are always confused for each other. But you know, May isn't me. But I had to inhabit her. I had to animate her. And I found I could find ways to do that if I pretended that I was out in the world with May. What would May say about this? What would May see? What would May be observing? And I started doing that a little bit after I'd heard Stuart Onan speak. And it helped. It really helped because I found through that I could put May in situations that hadn't occurred to me before I thought about bringing her out into the world with me, if that makes any sense.
I love that. And what are the odds? Stuart Onan is going to be on the show the week after next. So I'll be sure to bring that up.
Have you read Henry himself?
I have not read it yet, but it is certainly, it is the next on the pile of the books. Yeah, it's next on the pile.
Right, right.
there's a big pile.
That's so cool.
But I mean, that form of method acting, I guess, is how Rebecca Mackay had put it as she walked around Chicago in the heads of her characters and, you know, looking in the shops they would look into. And that sense of, I guess you would call it kind of method acting, I think is a great technique. And somebody else was telling me, I forget who it was, that they would walk around with their phone, like in Central Park, and record notes of what their character was observing through the character's eyes as opposed to their own eyes. I think, you know, that's that's a helpful way to do it.
That's right. It's just one of those things that seems simple, but until you hear it and think through it. And again, I think you have to have your character pretty much in mind. You know, I'm not sure you can do this with a blank page. I think you have to sort of know already the character you're working with. And then once you know some things about her or him, then you can sort of do this trick of going out into the world with them. Yeah. And then then sometimes things write themselves. little vignettes just happened, and you think that's perfect, and it's kind of mysterious.
It's magical. But. Yeah, it's magic, right? Oh, it kills me. We're drawing down on our time. Are there last minute words of wisdom or advice now that you've done novels, short story collections? Kind of you've given us a lot of wisdom here, but if there's other advice or things that have sustained you or you found helpful, we love to hear all of that.
Well, let me think. Never throw anything out. It's really true. You never know what's going to inspire you or what will seem more interesting a few years down the road, even if you feel like giving up on it now. I've rejuvenated stories. I've found, you know, bits of old stories became part of Rules for Visiting. So never throw anything out. And I guess, I feel as if I finally reached a point where I think every book's different, and so I say this with some hesitation, but at some point you do begin to know what your process is, and then you can trust it a little bit. And so even if you're not productive every day, you believe that it will come back, it will come again, and you will be productive again, that you have a process and it will be okay.
Are you one of those 1,000-word-a-day writers or a little bit more?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm really not. I'm jealous of them. I think that's great, but I never have been. I feel bad about it, and I never will be.
You don't have to feel bad about it because it's working. Whatever you're doing is working. So don't.
right. Didn't I just say I'm trying to trust in my process?
Right. More? Don't do it yet. Don't mess with the process.
That's right.
And tell us where we can find out more about you online.
Well, I have a website. Yes. It's my whole name, JessicaFrancisCain.com. And I'm on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook.
And you're on book tour. You're going, I don't know that you're close to us, but you're in Northern California.
Yes. Okay. Yes, I'm going to the Bay Area, San Francisco, the Bay Area. Where are you? You are?
We're in Southern California. We're in Irvine, in UCI.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
I knew that. Yes.
But, you know.
No, I'm not coming down there.
Listeners are all over the place, so you'll be.
That's right.
And I assume a copy of the schedule is on your website so people can find you.
It is. Yes, under my events. Yes. So it's true. It's my first, fourth book and first official book tour sort of thing. So it's very exciting.
I love it. Congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Jessica Frances Cain.
Thanks very much.
The book is Rules for Visiting.